West Coast, was conveniently turned off immediately after the Fukushima triple meltdown disaster began. So without reliable data, it's been easy for all the pro-nuclear powers that be to deny that any radioactive particles from Fukushima so much as touched American shores, nor would they ever. But now, citizen scientists have been taken to our coastal waters and sending samples to the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution for radiation testing. Which is why, when you hear a report from Woods Hole, state,
"Now we see cesium-137 levels at locations along the coastlines in California, Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, and Hawaii, as well as higher levels offshore. This increase, as well as our finding of cesium-134 in these elevated samples, provides clear evidence that Fukushima contamination has reached our shores."
Well, when you hear information like that from a verifiable scientific source, there's no doubt but that you are in the seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we examine the recent spike in radiation levels recorded in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of Northern California. We'll have two interviews with people directly involved in this project: John Bertucci of Fukushima Response Campaign and Molly P. Johnson of San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. Then, a continuation of our Voices from Japan series, an interview with filmmaker Hitomi Kaminaka, whose film Little Voices from Fukushima is about to embark on a U.S. tour. We will also have the week's nuclear news, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, activist shoutouts, and more honest nuclear information than porn star Stormy Daniels will be asked during her next lie detector test. All of this coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, March 20th, 2018, and here is the week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting out in the U.S., where Russian hackers are conducting a broad assault on the U.S. electric grid, water processing plants, air transportation facilities, and other targets in rolling attacks. And this includes nuclear. On March 15, the Department of Homeland Security and the Federal Bureau of Investigation officially confirmed that Russian hackers have been targeting U.S. nuclear power plants and other critical facilities since at least 2016. Regardless, the U.S. nuclear industry has been pressuring the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to relax its cybersecurity standards. According to Energy Secretary Rick Perry, speaking with lawmakers during a hearing, cyber attacks are literally happening hundreds of thousands of times a day. The warfare that goes on in cyberspace is real. It's serious. Edwin Lyman, a senior scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists, issued a statement that said, "Although the systems that control the most critical safety equipment at U.S. nuclear plants are analog-based and largely immune to cyber attacks, many other plant systems with important safety and security functions are digital and could be compromised." He went on to say, "Therefore, the nuclear industry's petition to limit the scope of Nuclear Regulatory Commission cyber protection safeguards to only those systems with direct impact on safety is foolhardy at best, and at worst, downright dangerous." Interestingly, nuclear apologist James Kanka of Forbes.com was published within 8 hours of the report coming out from the government with the headline, Russia hacks into U.S. power plants, but nuclear reactors should be impervious. Should being one of those words that is conditional and has the implication that maybe it isn't so. All that spin making you dizzy, James? An interesting factoid buried in all the many stories that sourced this report is the information that hackers downloaded a small image displayed on a target organization's human resource page. We don't know that this was nuclear, but it could have been. By blowing up the photo, the attackers revealed a high-resolution photo that displayed control systems equipment models and status information in the background, a considerable oversight and evidence of just how unevenly implemented basic operational security precautions can be in the energy sector. Bob Alvarez, a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies and former White House advisor on national security and the environment from 1993 to 1999, has published a powerful article, New Nuclear Policy Expands Arms Race with Russia, China. He parses the information brilliantly with plenty of footnotes and reference points, and we will have a link up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 352. More headaches at the Hanford site in southeastern Washington state. The federal government is demanding that the company building a giant nuclear waste treatment plant provide records proving that the steel used in the nearly $17 billion project meet safety standards. The U.S. Department of Energy says in a letter obtained by the Associated Press that records needed to ensure that the structural steel used in the project is safe are either missing or of, quote, indeterminate quality. In a letter sent on March 6th from DOE's Office of River Protection in Richland, Washington, to Bechtel National Incorporated, it stated, this condition is a potentially unrecoverable quality issue. And the EPA gave Bechtel National 14 days to provide proof that work on the project should continue. There's that word should again. The nuclear industry is shoulding all over itself. A new study from NASA has found that astronaut Scott Kelly's genes are no longer identical to those of his identical twin after Kelly spent a year in space. 7% of his genes no longer match those of his twin, Mark. Scott Kelly spent 1 year aboard the International Space Station during the study while his brother remained on Earth. And Bob Alvarez points out, it might be possible that mutations in astronaut Scott Kelly's DNA were brought about from cosmic radiation exposure, which is considerable when orbiting for a prolonged period beyond the Earth's protective atmospheric shield. Mining groups are pushing the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn an Obama-era rule banning uranium mining near Grand Canyon National Park. This in the latest push to open up public lands to the irreversible destruction caused by industry. There is currently a 20-year ban on mining that land that the Havasupai tribe relies on for their water. And as if that's not crazy enough,
nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, numbnuts of the week.
The late evangelist Billy Graham's daughter, Anne Graham Lotz, has said that God will punish America's immorality with a nuclear strike because we deserve it. Isn't that special? Lotz says she believes severe judgment is coming and has partly begun. And I'm talking about something like a nuclear strike, something major that would be a game changer for America because we are so defiant and rebellious and idolatrous and immoral and we know better. You know, evangelicals want the world to end rather than be disappointed in their expectation of it happening. But lady,
You can keep the ultimate justification of your lives and your beliefs away from anything that's going to end the rest of our lives. And whatever happened to Christian charity, love, turn the other cheek, thou shalt not kill. So if you want some nuclear revenge, Lot, why don't you just go build yourself a nice little resort home on the Hanford Reservation or in North St. Louis or close to Three Mile Island? Because with you calling for a nuclear strike just as a wee little bit of revenge on just the sinners, you are genuinely and certifiably this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of the week.
Over to Japan, where the government gives yet another lesson in how to rig the nuclear numbers. NHK has learned that only 35% of workers who responded to the March 2011 nuclear accident at the Fukushima Daiichi plant have been checked for the long-term effects of radiation. Some 20,000 workers who entered the plant within 9 months of the accident are to undergo lifelong monitoring that includes blood tests and thyroid exams. During the nuclear crisis, many plant workers were exposed to radiation beyond the government limit of 100 millisieverts. The government then temporarily raised the limit to 250 millisieverts so that work could continue. Note that based on the linear no threshold model, which is the gold standard for understanding exposure to radiation, there is no safe level of radiation to which a human being can be exposed. And the Fukushima food fight continues. An event in Thailand promoting flounder from Fukushima has been canceled amid concerns from consumers. The Fukushima prefectural government says a consumer group raised concerns about the safety of the fish, which was at an event being held at a Japanese restaurant and scheduled to run through the end of the month. But the protesting group, which interestingly was not named, said the fish were caught in contaminated waters and dangerous to eat. Nearly 130 kilograms of flounder had been exported from Fukushima to Thailand, but close to half of that remains untouched, and exports are essentially halted. In the wake of that protest, 11 Japanese restaurants in the Thai capital of Bangkok have stopped serving imported fish caught off the coast of Fukushima, and representatives of a Thai environmental group told NHK that the names of local stores selling marine products from Fukushima should be made public. This official said that while it is known that Japan has strict safety standards, trusting them is another matter. This was not fan mail from some flounder. In Canada, Ontario's Bruce Power has partnered with the Council of the Great Lakes Region to conduct a 3-year study of the impact of climate change on the region. The study will investigate the impacts on the region's ecosystems as well as corporate action to tackle climate change locally and regionally. Sounds good, doesn't it? Until you realize that this story was issued by World Nuclear News and that Bruce Power is not only the largest nuclear generating station in the world with 8, count them, 8 nuclear reactors, but they're the people behind the Great Lakes Waste Dump, the proposal to create a permanent storage repository for high-level nuclear waste from radioactive reactors less than 1 mile from the shores of Lake Huron. I wonder what their results will be and what their recommendations will be 3 years from now. I wonder. In Scotland, during a recent cold weather snap, excessive amounts of seaweed entered the cooling systems of the Torness nuclear reactor, causing one reactor to be closed. This is not the first time that Torness has been affected by seaborne nuisances, or soldiers of the ocean, as they might be called. The site was closed twice in 2013 due to seaweed clogging the plant's cooling system, and jellyfish caused the plant's units to be shut down in 2011. So if spineless jellyfish can shut down a nuclear reactor, so can any of us. George Monbiot, a virulent pro-nuker who writes for The Guardian in England, has been diagnosed with prostate cancer at the young age of 55. As Professor Chris Busby, one of Monbiot's favorite targets, wrote, Monbiot was born in 1963 at the peak of the atmospheric test fallout. He is thus a peak at-risk member of a cohort of those exposed in the womb to the fallout, 1959 to 1963, and currently suffering the consequences of exposure to strontium-90 in the milk and measured in children's bones. This fallout cohort is now entering the cancer bracket, and these people are driving up the cancer rates in the Northern Hemisphere. Nuclear gives us so much to look forward to. We'll have this week's featured interviews in just a moment. But first, every week, 52 weeks a year, Nuclear Hot Seat presents programs filled with verifiable news and unique interviews on Fukushima and every other aspect of the nuclear issue we can find. The show has interviewed people in Japan, India, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the EU, UK, Ireland, and all over the U.S., because nuclear problems encircle our precious globe, and no one is immune to its consequences. That's why, when you need to know the nuclear news, you can reliably turn to Nuclear Hot Seat. Every week, we bring you a range of stories and interviews on nuclear issues, as well as attitude, humor, context, and occasional outbursts of rage. But we don't take liberty with the facts. Everything we share is verified by news stories, research studies, and the keen observations of genuine experts who are not necessarily aligned with the nuclear industry. We are supported exclusively by the generosity of listeners like you, so please take a moment to help us out. You can make a donation of any size by going to nuclearhotseat.com and clicking on the big red donate button. Don't think your donation is too small to help, because everything is important to us. Your support now and throughout the year will help us keep bringing you the best, most up-to-date information on what's going on with nuclear issues around the world. So thank you for listening. Thank you for caring. And know that whatever you can do to assist us as we grow our reach further into the world, you have my gratitude. Here are this week's featured interviews. Within the last 2 weeks, we've received news that radiation levels in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of Northern California have measured a dramatic increase since the last reading. These new readings came out of a collaboration between citizen scientists and the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. I spoke with two people directly involved in this testing process. First, John Bertucci. He is admin at Fukushima Response Campaign on Facebook and a longtime anti-nuclear activist. He was essential in the creation of the human sign Fukushima is here on a beach just south of San Francisco, a photo of which we will be using for this week's show. John is also a veteran producer and a director of independent films. He's been executive director of PCA TV since 2008, where he most recently shepherded the successful creation of KPCA Community Radio for Petaluma, California.
John Bertucci, thank you so much for joining us this morning on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Libby.
Let's start out with a little discussion, a little orientation to this water sampling project. What is going on to find out radiation content in the Pacific Ocean in Northern California?
Well, I work with a group called Fukushima Response. We formed in early 2012. We were animated by Representative Ron Wyden's visit to Fukushima, and he came back, wanted to do a global response, so we thought we would mobilize that. That didn't pan out. We shifted into monitoring and reporting our results, and that's been a long-term project. We just received significant levels in one of our samples, so that's the big news here.
That's what we're going to be getting to, but a little bit more on the background.
We were a group that got to know each other in Occupy and learned some working group techniques and zeroed in on Fukushima as our project. As soon as it happened, as soon as the explosions were seen, we knew how bad it was. And we also live in this region. The West Coast was pretty hard hit, so we started monitoring, and we were blessed with the fact that Dan Seith of MedCom, International MedCom, is not far from where we all live. And our group, we worked hard. We were the ones that organized the human mural in San Francisco. And
Fukushima is here on the beach. We used that on Nuclear Hot Seat. It was quite impressive.
Thank you. You helped spread the word. We were meeting like twice a month, and after the beach event, we had like 50 people coming to our meetings, which was not really a work group. It was more informational. And right now, 5 years later, we're about a half dozen people who meet monthly. The monitoring project was started in 2013 and is just bearing fruit. We had three projects in the works. One, we've been doing inspector averages daily, testing rain and that sort of thing. But the CPMs on that level are pretty anecdotal. You can see an increase or a decrease, but not much else. So we, working with Dan, we got involved with Ken Bissler's Our Radioactive Ocean project. Ken Bissler is a scientist who organized an interactive website called Our Radioactive Ocean. For $550, you will be sent a container to gather 5 gallons of Pacific Ocean seawater, and it's prepaid return, and then the sampling happens. And we've been doing that since 2016 at the Bodega Head, which is kind of a famous spot. That's where the PG&E wanted to put a nuclear reactor, and the people of the region shut it down. So we've got this sample going in 2016.
What are the most recent findings from that sampling at Bodega Head?
Well, I've got the results for three samplings of ocean water collected at the surf level, and they've grown from 1.6 cesium-137 in 2016 to 2.2 at the end of 2016, and our recent results came in with 6.9 becquerels of cesium-137 per cubic meter of seawater. This was a sample that we did in October, and we just got the result early this year from the Woods Hole people.
That seems like a significant jump, an important jump in the increase in radiation. What does that signify to you and the others?
Well, most effectively, it signifies that the quantity of contamination is growing. Now, I've heard that it was anticipated that the bulk of the ocean plume would hit the West Coast in 2017 and 18. So this could be something that could peak and then drift off. But we all know that there's more being generated at that site. So it's a constant flow into the ocean, into our food chain. And all prognoses about impacts conveniently skip the part about ingested contamination as opposed to in the air or walking past something. When it's in your lungs, it's different. When it's in your bones, it's different. So we see this as a continuation of Fukushima's here. This is something we realized in 2011, that it will always be here, and we're working to monitor the regional impacts.
What might be the impact on fish, seaweed, and agriculture that's just inland from the ocean, but that receives moisture from the morning marine layer?
We do know that the aerosol contamination, that which was exploded into the atmosphere, hit the West Coast pretty hard. The official monitors along the coast were turned off conveniently at that period, and I think it was Arne Gunderson and Marco Kaltefend who tested air filters from Seattle and found hot particles. So there were times when the West Coast was getting a higher dose than Japan in the immediate aftermath of the disaster. So we know that's in the atmosphere. We see the growing levels in the ocean, which has been monitored over time, and you can see it accumulating. Now, that gets into a spiritual discussion eventually, because, yes, it's going to go up the food chain and it's going to contaminate the populace. There's a lot of other different impacts, like your immune system will deteriorate, and we've had a very heavy flu season. So is there a correlation there? We're on the ground trying to live in Northern California, and we wanted to know these levels. We were testing for years before we had anything really significant, but also because we wanted to make sure our protocols were credible and stable. And that's why this latest level is quite significant. It shows an increase, and we're confident that it means something. You know, if you go to the Woods Hole, the Our Radioactive Ocean website, there are maps with dates. You can pick a year, you can click in, you can see where various people up and down the coast have gathered 5 gallons of water and sent it back east. And the samples are there. We have a letter from Ken and Jessica Drydale. I could read it. Hello, friends of Our Radioactive Ocean. As we near the 7-year anniversary of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant accident, I would question the word accident, but we continue to see increasing cesium concentrations arriving on the west coast of North America. We wanted to let you know that we have an update on our website under ourradioactiveocean.org/results that shows a map of results as well as some trends at some of your sampling sites. You will find this below the usual pushpin map of our results. Our most recent sample from Bodega Head on October 30th, 2017 shows 6.9 becquerels per square meter of cesium-137, and at San Luis Obispo they found 6.8 in a sample taken on February 2nd, 2018. And it goes on with the map and the picture.
We'll have links up to the Woods Hole information on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode. We interviewed Sean Bonner of SafeCast, which does international background mapping of radiation levels. Literally, I think he's got all 7 continents now. This was for Nuclear Hot Seat number 349 on February 27th of 2018. What is your group's relationship with SafeCast?
Basically through Dan Seith, who worked with SafeCast from the inception of that project. Dan was involved in a lot of the design for the nano detector. Growing out of this Fukushima response and activism on the ground, we connected with the Bodega Head Marine Biology Lab. When Dan got together with them, we floated an idea for a 24/7 probe in the ocean. And this took a couple of years as well to organize, and Dan hooked it up with SafeCast. So it is now an ongoing probe of ocean water off Bodega Head, and it has real-time data posted on the SafeCast site.
That's very exciting information because, of course, it will be correlated with all of their other readings and continue to build the picture of what's happening in terms of radioactive contamination.
Yes.
What other activities has Fukushima Response been involved with?
Well, we table a lot around different events. We do anniversary celebrations. We connect with the Peace Crane Project here in Petaluma on Hiroshima Day. We do Geiger counter demonstrations in a public park. That's quite effective. Just the click, click, click attracts an audience. And I've given lectures. I just recently spoke to a group of students at Sonoma State. That was for the 7th anniversary, and we continue our monitoring project. We have, with Dan, or I should say Dan at MedCom, has invested in a Chromet sample inspector high-performance monitor for testing food, soil, and plants, and that is in working condition. We're still developing our protocols for accepting samples and testing, trying to calibrate correctly. But that's the CPMs that you get from the probe or from your inspector, it's relative information. But when you actually have the fingerprint of a certain isotope, then you have concrete data. And that's what we got from the Woods Hole setup. I think it's quite interesting, the citizen science sampling up and down the coast. And if you have a chance to go to that website and click on some of the push pins, you'll see pictures of the families or the students that went out and got the water because they want to know. It's a long-term project, watching the rising threat from that Daiichi disaster and anticipating the next one.
I don't even know what to say in the wake of that because it's kind of like, oh, let's sit and watch the grass grow. Oh, let's watch the radiation levels increase slowly. Oh, just went up another tick.
Yep. I confess a certain futility as well because, you know, we're just in a whirlwind of craziness in this country right now, and it's hard to keep track of the mess we've already made.
If people wish to follow the work of Fukushima Response and be aware of what you're doing, perhaps find ways to participate if they're on the West Coast, or model what you're doing in their own area, where can they go to get more information?
Well, we have a website, FukushimaResponse.org, and one of our members monitors that or manages that. And it's got more the archival material. I admin a Facebook page almost daily with news that I get from other Facebook pages and other friends around the world, actually. That's called Fukushima Response Campaign. I just posted a map there today from the Westlake landfill, and I want to salute you, Libby, for all the work you're doing on their behalf. I applaud you.
Thank you. I have a theater background. Applause is always appreciated.
Then John spoke of how testing is done by different groups and individuals up and down the coast and how they work with Woods Hole.
I see now where you're talking about the San Luis Obispo reading. I hadn't really factored that in. We don't work together. We're all working with Woods Hole, our radioactive ocean. It's a relationship of you send them money, they send you the material for the sampling, and then they send the sample results back. And a lot of us on the West Coast, and it's not just the two of us who got these readings, have been doing this for years. And so there is a database that's building on that website, and it's interesting to look at. But again, we were very hesitant to go public with our project until we had confidence in our data, that our protocols were solid and that the data was significant. And it took a month or two to write the press release.
The care that you're taking is deeply appreciated, because I think you're aware that there's a lot of echo chamber about the Pacific Ocean and the level of contamination and the like. So your specificity is appreciated, and anything shows up, let us know. But for now, John Bertucci, thank you so much for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
You're welcome. Keep it up.
John Bertucci of the Fukushima Response Campaign. To find out information on the radiation readings 230 miles down the coast at San Luis Obispo, I spoke with Molly P. Johnson of San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. She's also with Grandmothers for Peace and several other anti-nuclear pro-environment organizations.
Tell me about the Mothers for Peace involvement in testing the Pacific Ocean for radiation levels.
Woods Hole put out the call in late 2013 for people to volunteer to start testing the waters off of our western coast. And so Mothers for Peace, thinking this was going to be a very necessary thing to do, so we volunteered. And we did our first test on February 9th of 2014. And our first test, there was 1.8 measurements. And our last test is 6.8 of cesium-137.
So between that first reading in February of 2014 and now, which is approximately 4 years later, because I know there's a time lag between taking the sample and getting the result, but in that period of time, you have seen an increase of 5 becquerels per kilogram of water. Is that correct?
Correct. The date of our last test was February 2nd, so we're right close to being almost exactly 4 years.
As I told John at his numbers, too, that's an alarming jump, and I'm wondering, how is that impacting people who live along the coast? What has the response been to this information, or have people been paying any attention to it at all?
I'll go backwards with your questions. People have not been paying any attention to it at all. I have the update from Woods Hole Oceanographic, and I encourage anyone who's interested in this to go to their site, ourradioactiveocean.org. They explain the testing. They explain what they're looking for. You can see all the results, so I really recommend people do that. So I have their report that was just done this month. Their thing is that it's low. The levels are low, and therefore not harmful. But there are those of us that know better because of bioaccumulation etc. But in their words, and if I could, I'll read you this paragraph from them that pretty much wraps it up. It is important to note that prior to these events in 2011, there was already measurable amounts of radioactive fallout in the ocean from the testing of nuclear weapons that peaked in the 1960s. For cesium-137, levels in Pacific Ocean waters were generally below 2.0 becquerels per cubic meter. Now we see cesium-137 levels above this level at locations along the coastlines in California, Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, and Hawaii, as well as higher levels offshore. This increase, as well as our finding of cesium-134 in these elevated samples, provides clear evidence that Fukushima contamination has reached our shores.
When you read that for the first time, that confirmation of radiation level, what went through your mind?
I was expecting it. I knew it was coming. I'm very happy that we did not find the cesium-134 in our area.
And why is that?
That would have indicated that the radiation from Fukushima had reached us much quicker. But it is going up, and we are going to continue to do this testing.
Why is it that cesium-134 would be a marker of radiation from Fukushima, but cesium-137, am I hearing this right, is not a marker from Fukushima, and yet the radiation levels have gone up?
Well, because they knew there's already cesium-137 in the ocean. If you tested the ocean prior to Fukushima, you would have found cesium-137 because of the above-ground testing. So they wanted to find, they chose another radionuclide that they would know for sure that when they're testing, it's like, okay, why is this one going up, 137? Now, if they're testing for the 134, then they know that that is from Fukushima. We have never had measurable cesium-134 in our samples. Bodega Bay has, and also between Los Angeles and San Diego has, and another couple places, I do believe. But we never had the 134 in our samples.
137 is what has increased.
Yes.
But 134 is the marker that is being used from Fukushima?
Not now, because it's so short-lived, but in the beginning it was. So they could differentiate in their samples whether the 137 they had in their samples was what was there because of the testing. They needed a marker that they knew would be from Fukushima because it's so short-lived, and that was 134.
Then how are they differentiating between pre-existing cesium-137, meaning left over from all of the atmospheric bomb tests, and the current rise of cesium-137, is that also coming from Fukushima?
The only way it could rise would be from Fukushima, or if there had been another nuclear accident somewhere that was dumping these radionuclides into the ocean. But obviously the levels, and that's why the testing is important, because this shows that there is more radioactivity in our ocean, and the 137 is a marker for that. So that's what's happening. And because the cesium-134 is short-lived, it's probably getting to the point where it's decaying enough to where it's less detectable anyway. But the 137 is longer-lived. It's got a hazardous life of 300 years. So they'll be able to measure that for a very long time.
Well, certainly longer than you or I are going to be around. There have been stories or predictions or warnings that there were dead zones of animals and sea life on the shore in Northern California going into Oregon and up to Washington. Is there anything that you have heard that correlates with a complete die-off or a cascading die-off of sea creatures with this increased radiation?
You know, I have seen those as well.
Seen those meaning the story?
Yes. And I believe that the radiation is definitely affecting our oceans. I personally believe this is why we're seeing whales much closer to shore than we used to, that we're seeing certain water creatures that are coming closer to shore. I think it's because they're trying to get away from the radioactivity that's coming in our direction.
Mothers for Peace is going to continue to do these samples. What do you believe is the trajectory? Is it possible that the radiation has peaked and will be going down? Or is it just going to keep increasing as Fukushima continues to leak its radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean?
Precisely. That's what will happen. It will continue to go up. As Ellen Caldicott said, a nuclear accident never ends. We just have to keep track of what's going on in our ocean, and this is why we are committed to continue doing this testing. And it costs us $550 every time we do one of these tests, and we do fundraising to get the money to do that because we feel it is vitally important that this testing continue so that we know what's going on our coastline.
Molly P. Johnson of San Luis Obispo, Mothers for Peace. All of the links mentioned in these two interviews will be clickably linked on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 352. Activist shout out! The anniversaries of Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, and Fukushima in March and April each year bring a fresh round of events featuring expert speakers, activist-led demonstrations, and film screenings focused on nuclear issues. Earlier this month, if you listened to last week's show, I participated in a panel following a screening of Nuclear Cattle here in Los Angeles. So if you haven't had a chance to see a nuclear-themed film yet this year, and if you live in Washington, D.C. or Southern California, there is a chance for you to meet a prolific filmmaker from Japan who puts a human face on those who have been victimized by nuclear accidents and the global nuclear war machine. Today, we briefly chat with director Hitomi Kaminaka, whose most recent film, Little Voices from Fukushima, will be screening in Washington, D.C. and San Clemente, California. An earlier film of hers, Hibakusha at the End of the World, will be screening in San Diego. Little Voices from Fukushima contrast the stories of mothers in Fukushima about 3 years after the accident with mothers in Belarus 25 years after Chernobyl. She follows the Fukushima mothers as they make choices and face challenges in their daily lives, living in a radioactively contaminated area, and provides a window into their probable future in the families affected by Chernobyl. To give you a bit of background, Hibakusha at the End of the World, Kaminaka's first nuclear-related film, has won several awards. The film contrasts the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in the state of Washington, the effects of depleted uranium on Iraqi citizens after the first Gulf War, and victims in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Hibakusha was the first in Kaminaka's nuclear trilogy. Her second work, Rokasho Rhapsody, in 2006, covered Rokasho village residents' rifts and struggles resulting from construction of the Rokasho reprocessing plant in Aomori Prefecture, Japan. Her third work, Ashes to Honey, in 2010, documented local residents' struggle against the construction of a nuclear power plant in Yamaguchi Prefecture. Nuclear Hot Seat's Voices from Japan correspondent recently met with Kaminaka during a film festival held in Saitama, Japan, a city on Tokyo's northeastern border. Hitomi Kaminaka, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat. Could you tell us what makes Little Voices from Fukushima special?
小さき声のカノンは Little Voices from Fukushima は 3年半ぐらいかけて
To make 小さき声のカノン, or as it is known in English, Little Voices from Fukushima. I traveled to Fukushima many times over a span of 3.5 years. One of the main distinguishing features of the film is that it compares mothers from Fukushima and Belarus, or Chernobyl, side by side. The Fukushima accident occurred 25 years after Chernobyl. Both moms in Fukushima and in Chernobyl experienced nuclear accidents and had to do many things to protect their children. The mothers in Fukushima are beginners, and Chernobyl moms can be considered veterans. Both Fukushima and Chernobyl moms appear in the movie. I think the realistic imagery of the mothers in this film makes it unique. The Fukushima moms really worried about appearing in my movie. Appearing in the media and expressing their true feelings about the nuclear accident and their worries about their children's health was something that was already causing them a lot of psychological stress when I started my research. Up until the end, they worried about telling what was in their hearts and whether they would be forgiven for appearing in the film. I think this situation is really unique to Fukushima. They were very concerned, but they made the decision to allow me to reveal their faces and real names in the film. When I finished the film, I premiered it in Tokyo and Fukushima. In Fukushima, people who came to see the film said, "Is it really okay for the people in the film to appear on screen like this? How were you able to make this film?" In other words, interviewing people like I did for Little Voices from Fukushima is nearly impossible.
Can you explain why someone might not want to appear in a film like yours?
Within 6 months of the accident, the Japanese government had already started their Everything is Safe campaign. They quickly began to depict people's comments and worries, such as, "Fukushima is contaminated," "Fukushima is polluted," or "Fukushima is dangerous," as discrimination against Fukushima. That campaign spread with great momentum and speed. So if mothers were to express their worries about radiation out loud, they would be accused of encouraging harmful rumors. It wasn't anyone special that would engage in bashing against people who would speak out. It was ordinary community members. Suppression of the speech of mothers dealing with any and all kinds of worries had already begun, so ordinary moms were very frightened to speak out. They didn't see any personal benefit in expressing their views. That sensibility was planted in people's minds early on.
So that's why they wouldn't speak to the media.
Nothing good would come from speaking to the media. I think that's what makes the film worth seeing, what makes it unique.
Thank you very much for speaking to Nuclear Hot Seat, and we are looking forward to seeing Little Voices from Fukushima here in the United States.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it too.
よかった。私も楽しみにしています。
ありがとうございました。
はい、ありがとうございます。
That was filmmaker Hitomi Kaminaka, director of Little Voices from Fukushima. She will be screening that film on March 22nd at Georgetown University, followed by a Q&A with Dr. Norma Fields. Nuclear Information and Resource Service will hold a screening on March 26 in Washington, D.C. Discussion will follow with Kaminaka and activist Ruiko Muto, who has been featured on Nuclear Hot Seat's Voices from Japan in past years. In Southern California, Kaminaka will screen Little Voices from Fukushima on March 29 in San Clemente, and Hibakusha at the End of the World on April 1st in San Diego. Links to all of the events, film trailers, and Kaminaka's website will be posted at nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 352. Here's this week's final thought. Next week, March 28, marks the 39th anniversary of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island, a nuclear partial meltdown with consequences that we do not yet understand, and few in power want us even to consider. I've produced a Three Mile Island anniversary show every year since Nuclear Hot Seat began, but this year I have some new information to work with. About 6 weeks ago, I discovered the Facebook private page, Three Mile Island Survivors. Scrolling down what was visible, I felt myself eerily transported to a place I never knew existed, a place where I could say Three Mile Island, or TMI, and be met with understanding of what it was, what it meant, and the shared terror of that experience. What I came to realize with crystal clarity is that Three Mile Island, seemingly the forgotten nuclear disaster, is far from over. The worst of its health impacts have been making themselves known all along, and much like those fooled into living next to World War II nuclear weapons waste in North St. Louis, the people around Three Mile Island are suffering. There are currently almost 4,000 members to the Facebook TMI Survivors Group. 4,000 people who have stories like mine. Only theirs is most likely worse because I got out after 2 weeks, and they've lived with the aftermath directly for 39 years. The founders and admins of the page have put together an event for the 39th anniversary. There will be a panel of journalists who covered the accident as it happened, a second panel discussion of the health consequences of exposure to radiation will include two activists I know and have interviewed, Cindy Folkers, radiation specialist at Beyond Nuclear, and Heidi Huttner, professor of literature and eco everything I care about for Stony Brook University in New York. There will also be ample opportunity for me to meet, mingle with, and hopefully get interviews from people who are there to attend the event. I have not been back to Three Mile Island since I fled the accident 2 weeks after it happened. I fiercely debated with myself whether to travel to this event or not, my overwhelming desire to attend battling with my bank account. Then I realized, just like when it comes to producing Nuclear Hot Seat, I can't not be there. This is where it all started for me. If not for Three Mile Island, I wouldn't be doing Nuclear Hot Seat or probably paying any attention to nuclear issues. This is where the life I was living ran into a brick wall of no longer an option. So I can't not go back. Quite honestly, the financial ding is huge. So if you are of a mind to help me with this part of my journey, I would really appreciate it. I will be producing a Nuclear Hot Seat based on this trip, which is scheduled to air in 2 weeks' time. So you will all get to walk the walk with me, and I will bring you voices from the people, the truth from the place. So my bags are packed. I'm leaving on a jet plane. I will be there. I'm going back to face the nuclear fears I've not yet released, to look my personal nuclear demon in the eye, and give it back a concentrated dose of the pain and rage and fear it planted in me 39 years ago. Probably take some more pictures, too. I have a whole passel you've never seen from when the accident happened. I do have a request. Could you help an activist out and send a contribution to help me with this journey? Any amount will be appreciated. As a bonus, for those of you who can donate $20 or more, I'll send a facsimile copy of the exact article I wrote for LA Weekly from the evacuation point. It was published only 3 weeks after the accident. If you can donate $100 or more, I'll send you that, plus an autographed copy of my book, Yes, I Glow in the Dark, 1 mile from Three Mile Island to Fukushima and Nuclear Hot Seat. It is on schedule to be published later this spring, and I've got my fingers crossed it will be done by late May, early June. And if anyone is up for a $500 donation, you will receive a personally dedicated and signed copy of the book, a signed 8x10 copy of the cover photo suitable for framing. This is a picture you have not seen before, as I've been holding it back, and it's a doozy. And you will also receive a mention in the book as having helped make the final chapter possible. You can contribute through the website at nuclearhotseat.com. Yes, the big red donate button. Next week, I will be presenting my annual Three Mile Island anniversary special. The following week, I've scheduled a report based upon this trip, the interviews with other survivors, the journalists, and my personal thoughts and feelings as I revisit the site of the accident that changed my life forever. I look forward to sharing it with all of you. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, March 20, 2018. First, my deepest thanks again to the Voices from Japan crew, our special correspondent in Japan, Yuji Kaneko, producer Beverly Finlay Kaneko, voiceover coordinator Kei Ogama, and voiceover artist Aki Tabe. Material from this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, deunrenard.wordpress.com, miningawareness.wordpress.com, dianuke.org, Beyond Nuclear, techcrunch.com, Union of Concerned Scientists, forbes.com, bloomberg.com, washingtonspectator.org, sfgate.com, thehill.com, themaven.net, mainichi.jp, nhk.or.jp, NewYorkTimes.com, the soul-dead cubicle drones who grind out press releases for World Nuclear News, and a shout-out to all of you, Nuclear Hot Seat listeners around the world, 123 countries strong on six continents and counting. We will have a new audit done for us in May in time for our anniversary in June. Plus, hello and thanks for listening to everyone who's on our growing network of broadcast stations in the U.S., all of you are the ones who share your love for life on this planet by being the kick-ass defenders of nuclear truth and supporters of atomic awareness that you are. I thank you for visiting the two Nuclear Hot Seat Facebook pages, the blog page and the podcast page. And if you haven't yet, be sure to stop by both. Click like, follow, post, and share. You can find all of our back episodes, 350 of them, at nuclearhotseat.com or on iTunes. And on the website, there's a new feature. If you put in the website and then add /blog, you'll be able to scan the episodes about 10 at a time. Theme music written by me, sung by Marilee Weber, accompaniment by John Barnard, recorded at Winslow Court Studio in Hollywood. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. We are copyright 2018, Libby, Halevi, and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. And if you appreciate verifiable weekly news updates about nuclear issues around the world, take a moment to send a donation of any size to nuclearhotseat.com. We really appreciate your support. This is Libby Halevi of Heartistry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that radioactive nuclear waste is forever. No one is immune to its impact on their health and safety. We have no way of safely storing it or neutralizing it. And still, the nuclear industry is creating more of it every day. There you go. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. So don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.